Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
W.C. Fields once said, "All roads lead to rum." But my guest today found out that all roads lead to Havana. And rum, of course. And we'll hear all about it today on A Taste of the Past.
My name's Jean Danger, and I'm the beverage director at Cienfuegos. Today we're going to be making a classic mojito. I learned a lot about this drink on my trip to Cuba. I went to visit the town of Cienfuegos. We were in search of the perfect daiquiri. Instead, we came away with the perfect mojito. 1 ounce of lime juice. Fresh lime juice is always key. 3/4 ounce of cane syrup. I love the flavor and the texture. It gives this double duty. 2 ounces of white rum. A handful of mint we'll put in the other tin. A couple pebbles of ice. We're going to give it one good press with a muddler. You don't want to muddle it too much. You want just the nice freshness. It's not to become too vegetal. Another little bit of pebbled ice. We will give it a whip shake. We'll transfer shaking tin, mint and all, into the glass. Get all those good leaves out of there. You'll take a spoon or the straw, whatever you have handy, and press down the mint leaves so you have a nice layer on the bottom. You get your pebble ice or cracked ice. Fill in on top. Press that down. We just need a little splash of soda. Get a straw in. We're gonna take some of the nice mint tops that we've reserved when you pick the leaves off of the bottom. You give them a good whap in the palm of your hand to get all of the oils and the aroma out. Put them right next to the straw so when you take a sip, you get a nice big whiff of that minty green goodness. And there you are, a classic mojito.
And that is a classic and sounds good. Wish I had one right now to drink. Well, just as there was the tradition for centuries to gather around punch bowls to share friendships and tales, today we tend to gather around cocktails. And cocktails that represent centuries of history, such as that mojito. And what better than classic cocktails? But what really makes a true classic cocktail, indisputable classic cocktail? Well, according to mixologist and cocktail historian Dave Wondrich, he says it has to meet three criteria. It has to have some kind of history, it has to have achieved lasting popularity or fame, and it has to taste great. And he says, okay, not just bewitching and delightful, but irresistible, whatever it is. And that mojito certainly sounded irresistible. My guests today are Jane Danger, who you heard mixing that wonderful cocktail, and Alla Lapushik, who are owners of Cienfuegos Rum Bar. It's a tropical gathering place in Manhattan's East Village. And they're here with me today to talk about their book, Cuban Cocktails. In that book, they have recreated the elegance and vibrant energy of Cuba's rich history and culture in all kinds of stories and histories about, indeed, classic cocktails. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
And so when I read that, what really makes a classic cocktail, do you agree?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it has to taste good, staying power, during the
have a little story behind it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot of these Cuban cocktails have great stories. The trouble you find, as I'm sure one Brit will let you know, is the problem when these drinks are being created, you're also drinking them. So some of the histories can be a little hazy. So we try to do our best and go back and you look to see where is the first date that this is ever noted and being written about. What is the first book this is in or the first magazine article? But it's kind of hard to tell who you get the first credit to, like the Martini, the Manhattan. Those are going back there. Right.
Or in the case of the Cuban cocktails, El Presidente.
Yes. That's,
you pretty much have that documented, I think.
Yeah, as close as we could get, definitely. Yeah.
Well, tell me, now this bar that you own, Cienfuegos, you own that together with Ravi Di Rossi. And tell me about the bar. Tell me about how you got there. Why Cuban cocktails and what started all that?
Well, Ala was actually on a bit before I was. She had worked on quite a few projects with Ravi, and they definitely had a vision.
Yeah, Ravi, he was very partial to rum, so we decided to use that as a starting point and focus on rum cocktails, and rum and Cuba are so intertwined. It just kind of was a natural progression to this sort of Cuba-centric rum bar.
Wow. And now, Ala, you've moved on to whiskey.
Yeah.
And focusing on whiskey at some whiskey bars, right?
Yeah, Post Office in Williamsburg and OTB.
Okay. So. And Jane, you are the beverage director for Cienfuegos.
Yes, and
okay.
Mother of Pearl, there's another bar. Okay. We're in the same complex as Amore Amargo, so we've got like a little Hogwarts of cocktail bars on the corner of 6 and 8. It's a lot of fun.
The attendees of Hogwarts grow up, right?
Oh, yes.
And get drunk.
Yeah, right. But you then took a trip together to Cuba. So how did that change your lives and change anything about what you presented, you know, in terms of the cocktails?
Oh man, it was great. It was really important. We decided almost last minute because it's easier now, but it's still really, really difficult mm-hmm. to get everything planned. It's still very expensive. And we just went for it. We went down. And the most beneficial part is because we know a lot about the history of Cuba and the history of Cuban cocktails and drinking culture there, but there's this large gap where we here don't know anything about what they're doing over there. So we really wanted to go down and see how the bartenders were making these drinks that we were reading about and what they were actually drinking now, you know, 60 years later
right.
from when we last knew about it.
Right.
Yeah. Very important. We had to like see it with our own eyes because a lot of bartenders, like she had said, we all know about this history, but nobody's seen it. Nobody's been able to talk to the bartenders and explain to them. And when we met a lot of bartenders, they were so surprised that we were, one, women bartenders, and two, just so interested. And, you know, they were really trying to wow us with their whiskey drinks. And we were like, well, actually, we're in search of like the perfect daiquiri and rum drinks. And this is what we're doing. And they're like, why? Okay. I mean, rum, you know, rum.
Yeah. And well, I'm sure a lot of them have lost a little bit of that history along the way. Let's just remind our listeners what we're talking about when we talk about all this history. I mean, you know, talk about, first of all, we have to go back to 1920 and Prohibition, right? I think that probably was the springboard.
Yeah, that doubled their tourism. Americans visiting Cuba, specifically Havana, it doubled. It was crazy, the flights that they were offering and the deals and just the way they were promoting it. I think they were very smart, especially the brand Bacardi, in kind of bringing people down there and saying, you know, get away from the dry land. Here's the beach. Come and have a drink with us. It's only 2 hours away.
Gave new importance to booze crews, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of the American talent, a lot of bartenders and bar owners just picked up everything they had. And, you know, Cuba was the closest place, went there and
so they relocated their business.
They
moved out of the U.S. and opened their business.
Some of them literally
took
their bars.
Every
like
part
actual.
Of their bar picked it up and moved it
yes.
over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think everyone remembers the scene out of The Godfather where, you know, it was the whole nightclub, you know, cocktail scene. But mm-hmm. that was post-Prohibition. But it was still such, the culture was still thick and heavy, and everyone went to Cuba to party, right? there so much happened in during that the Prohibition period. Bars built up, and that's when that, I mean, there was such an architectural boom time in Cuba. Beautiful. What was your reaction to? I mean, obviously, things have deteriorated today a bit, but what was your reaction when you got there? Were you surprised, or did it, you know, fulfill your expectations? What about, you know, the art, just walking down the streets?
It exceeded our expectations. I think, you know, it's a beautiful environment, and it's a very surreal environment. Because of, obviously, you know, its place in history, or it's sort of like pit stop in history, you know, kind of compared to where we are. And, you know, this beautiful architecture right next to this weird Soviet style architecture and all of it, and this, like gorgeous Caribbean haze, but it's a little deteriorated, but it's still bright and gorgeous. I don't know. It was like
being in a movie. It was very, like, something you would never think to see, because it is such a scene that people have seen in books and television, and then you're actually there, and don't know what to do with yourself. You're like,
you're on a movie set, but not.
Yeah.
I haven't had the opportunity to go, but, you know, I'm looking forward to it. Wanting to go soon before it gets, you know, too...
Before everyone wants to go.
Yeah. And I think that's already happening. They said there was something written there's because, of, you know, with the... you know, the trade opened up now, and travel getting more open now. The influx of American tourists have just been insurmountable in mm-hmm. terms of what they can, how they can handle them. That they've even run low on beer.
Oh, really?
They're going to have to switch to rum.
They have good beer.
They do.
Yeah. High
proof.
But let's switch over to rum. And what, you know, the so many of the cocktails that are classics from that era, and, you know, the Cuban cocktail culture, are really based on rum. What is it about the rum? And there are so many types of rum. Just give me a rundown on rum. That's a whole other show, of course, because it has kind of a dark history as well. But as far as the Cuban rum and the drinks, tell me a little bit about that and how it, you know, built up. And obviously the name that we'll all recognize, Bacardi, right?
Bacardi was a big part of Cuban rum. I mean, before that, you know, you think of rum and pirates, and it's kind of like this hot and oily molasses-based distillate that's just, you know, really full on. Well, you know, Bacardi got this great idea to use the continuous calm still that they were using to make Irish whiskey so light and wonderful. Mm-hmm. He took the combination of that and aging and then charcoal filtering so you could have this luscious, beautiful bodied rum that had some age on it, but you would take all the impurities out. And so it was a real game changer for what rum is and was. It's, you know,
what
created
kind of
a whole
rum
new
people wanted to drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was also working with a French cognac distiller who was in Cuba, so they were using a completely different kind of yeast. They were using quicker, lighter cognac yeast versus the slow, normal rum yeast. So they were getting this completely new product, and he was an amazing marketer. It was before people had labels, before rum was really bottled, and he knew that he needed to get people to recognize it as Bacardi's rum. So he, you know, put the bat label on it. He would sign every bottle, and he marketed it kind of for the first time and began the long history of Bacardi fighting for its trademarks in various forms.
It sounds like there's a deep story in that one, too.
Right? Yeah.
Well, tell me, there is, you mentioned the Havana Club rum. But we can't really get that here, or at least not yet.
No, not quite yet. And then that is where in lies that deep story of the back and forth between Bacardi, Havana Club, Puerto Rico, Cuba.
The United States government.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Who invented the pina colada? Who invented the mojito? It's really dirty, dirty stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure. Tell me, is Havana Club so different?
Well, no, the style is still the same. You have, you know, your French style rums, your English style, and then your Spanish style. So everything that they're doing is along those lines.
Yeah. A lot of it is, you know, you want what you can't have.
Right.
You
Yeah, so we love to bring it back when we travel. Anytime you go, you know, Havana Club is basically the well of the world. But when we travel, we love to bring it back. Like you go to Tokyo or, mm-hmm. you know, London or wherever, and they just have it there. And then it's our contraband, and we love to bring it back and give it as gifts to people. It's, you know, coveted.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that when you told people that you were bartenders, of course, there was, you know, people were a little shocked in Cuba. I mean, two women going who were bartenders.
Yeah.
but bartending has probably a better organized history in Cuba than it does in many place else. I mean, what I had read is that they had been organized since, you know, as a, not a union necessarily, but organized bartenders since about the early 20s, since probably when everyone was coming down from Prohibition, around 1924, maybe.
Yeah.
And had this manual, a manual of over 1,100 recipes with footnotes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we found their, well, they have like a bartender's guild, and we found someone pointed us in the direction of the manual, the guide, and it is, you know, it's a normal size book, a very, very tiny print with every cocktail you could think of listed, and every single one pretty much has a footnote, and they try to give you as much of a history as they can on it, from classics to, I think they have like Sex on the Beach in there and stuff, just every single
everything
cocktail.
You can think of,
yeah,
right?
They added to it.
Yeah. the version we got, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the old cocktails. Now, mint juleps, we know, have been around since the, you know, early 18th century or mid-18th century. But what about some of these classically Cuban cocktails? What's the oldest one that comes to mind that you can think of?
Well, there's, during our history and going back and all of the wars they had, there's the original Cuba Libre, which has nothing to do with Coca-Cola at mm-hmm. all. And we just found that, you know, honey played a big part in their cocktails for a long time. So that was really interesting. And on our travels, we went to a bar and they had, what was it on the menu?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we kind of found some really old cocktails as we traveled around. All of these bars had epic lists of just classics on classics of, you know, just anything from Manhattan's, the Sex on the Beaches.
What is Sex on the Beaches?
That's a vodka-based cocktail.
Yeah,
okay. So that's just, they, you know, I think some of the things that were popular here in the 70s and 80s somehow kind of slipped over there, but they had strange, you know, Manhattan variants and just all sorts of stuff that we kind of forgot during that time when the Sex on the Beaches and the Tequila Sunrises were so popular. But we found out that there is this amazing honeysuckle variation.
Yeah, it's called a Conchinchara. The name was escaping me for a second. It was just a combination of rum and citrus and honey that they drank a lot during the Seven-Year War. Is that one?
Or the 3-year?
That, well, the
lots
Spanish.
Lots of wars. Yeah, we're trying to get the Spanish out.
Yes, trying to get away from the Spanish.
Yeah.
You serve a variation at the bar with honeysuckle?
We do honeysuckle, or there are many variations. Bee's knees, if you're making it with gin, you can kind of sub all these things in, and that's definitely what makes a classic, is you have these formulas that you can put in, but a lot of them did start with rum, so.
All right. You know, it's interesting because we talked about how the culture really boomed during Prohibition, but then it continued, as we saw in the, you know, as I say, in whatever film clips you can see of, you know, of Cuba and Havana, and, you know, they've always taken place in nightclubs and bars. But then, of course, the revolution came in 59, and that must have changed the cocktail culture a bit, because they were not getting a lot of the liquors that imports that they needed for some of the cocktails. What happened then? Is there anything in particular that occurred? Rum probably became very important at the drinks at that point.
Yeah, I feel like then, you know, a lot became under the government control. That was something that we noticed when we were there, even getting our daiquiris and what we were looking for. Everything is kind of pasteurized and goes through the government. So I feel like a lot of the daiquiris and things we had, even though it was the same recipe as so many years ago, definitely tasted different to us. I'm sure their recipes had to change because of this.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we're going to talk about some more of these specific cocktails and punch bowls when we come back.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm. Consider Bardwell Farm is a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm, making award-winning raw cow and goat's milk cheeses in a not-too-far corner of Vermont. For Consider Bardwell, sustainability means caring for the land, raising their animals well, reducing waste, and helping their community, all in the name of happy animals and people and delicious cheeses. Consider Bardwell Farm is proud to support Heritage Radio Network as part of their food and farming community and a proud sponsor of all good conversations had over great cheese. Find them at your local cheese counter, at New York City Green Markets, and online at considerbardwellfarm.com.
Okay, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I am talking with Jane Danger and Ala Lepushik. They have written this wonderful book called Cuban Cocktails, and based on the bar Cienfuegos in the East Village in Manhattan. Now, you took a trip. We talked about your trip to Cuba, and unlike most people, you did not stop at Havana. You went directly to the southern coast. Tell us about that, a place that probably nobody knew existed.
Yeah, we flew into Cienfuegos on their one flight a week.
Better not miss that day.
No. Nope. And
so it is actually a town on the coast.
It is. It's a Cuban resort town. Lots of French Canadians seem to go there.
Surprisingly, yes. Yeah. It's their popular destination of choice.
So we flew into there, rented a car, and spent a couple days exploring Cienfuegos, which is the namesake of the bar. And
it means?
100 fires.
100 mm-hmm. fires. Okay.
It was beautiful there. It's a very, I mean, obviously it's a resort town in what's already a really gorgeous place. So it's kind of next level. Met some really great bartenders there, visited some nice places.
Now, what led you, I mean, obviously the bar was Cienfuegos, and whose idea was that, and what led you to go there?
Well, during the course of writing the book, neither of us had been to Cuba, and we just felt doing it justice and seeing the modern state of cocktails there and being able to really explain to people what is going on, because a lot of, you know, references we were looking to are just outdated, and it didn't seem substantial enough for us, and we were like, just it's our personalities as well as we're like, nope, we have to know ourselves. We're going. Let's get us on a plane. Let's do this. So it's kind of scary just arriving in Cuba and not knowing what to do with yourself. We're like, okay, well, what do we do now?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
we find out where to rent a car. Okay.
Isn't there a town nearby, a very famous name?
Oh, well, if we're going to be heading to the southeast a bit more, that's where, right outside, there's a beach, the Daiquiri.
The Daiquiri,
yeah,
right.
out of Santiago de Cuba. So we didn't get to venture that way. After our stay in Cienfuegos, we ended up driving straight through the middle of the country and going northwest to head to Havana, where we just got to see all sorts of terrain. And there is no Google Maps there or anything, so we kind of took to the road, and that was a real adventure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And what I loved is that you mentioned in the book that you would drive through the outskirts of town where there were more horses and horse carts on the road than there were cars, right?
Yeah, and those horses were none too pleased with
us.
No,
so many dirty looks from horses.
In road rage from a horse.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I've never competed for road space with a horse. I don't know how to do it right, I guess.
Well, you mentioned that some of the bartenders were surprised that you wanted to, that you asked about some of those, the old-fashioned, not an old-fashioned, but old-fashioned drinks, old classic drinks. So what is the modern culture today? What's going on with the cocktail culture today?
Well, I mean, it's kind of complicated. Some of the bars we went to that were attempting to do what was, you know, kind of like new for them was very Miami-ish.
Yeah, there are lots of like, you know, kind of blue curacao and these experimental techniques, which is really amazing, but, you know, kind of not necessarily what we were looking for. But it was, you know, fun to see their evolution and where they're trying to go.
Yeah, their fascination with like the new stuff is equivalent to our fascination with the old stuff. So tried to meet in the middle somewhere.
And that's really interesting. I think that's an interesting discovery, you mm-hmm. know, to find out that it's, you know, where we can maybe be mired in the past and trying to make that cool again. They really want to be cool with the new. Right?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the past, we couldn't talk about Cuban cocktail culture without having some of those big names attached to, you know, the heyday and pictures of and stories and tales, of course, of Ernest Hemingway, you know, holding up the bar. So mention a couple of those. Enlighten us.
Yeah, he's famous for, you know, there's a series of drinks that go along with a daiquiri named after him, the Hemingway daiquiri, which is a great blend of white rum, maraschino liqueur, which is made from cherry pits, so it's funky and has a little bit of cherry flavor. It's very aromatic. Fresh lime juice, fresh grapefruit, dash of sugar. Well, you know, Hemingway being who he is, pretty much all the sugar was taken out. The rum was doubled. The juice was taken down a bit, and it was frozen. So that was his style, the Papa Doble, which he was famous for sitting and drinking, you know, 14 in a seating too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that's definitely...
Definitely have to hold on to the bar for that.
Yeah, they're very refreshing, though. We actually went to the bar where he drank them and stood near his giant brass, you know...
Sat next to the statue and had a Papa Doble.
We ended up in a lot of Japanese tourist photos because we got those prime seats right there, so...
Well, actually, I read your recipe that you have in the book for the Papa Dobles, and tell us what that is, because to me, it sounded like a deliciously refreshing drink.
It is very... We scaled it a little to not necessarily Hemingway's spec. We added a little bit of sugar and a little more of the fresh grapefruit, which that's another one next to pineapple juice. You need fresh grapefruit because the sweetness that comes along with that is so crucial. It's so key. And then, yeah, you blend that all up, and it's the perfect, you know, summer sipper.
So it's a rum, grapefruit juice, and
lime,
white
and
rum.
Maraschino, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And so that's a great one for summer, any time of year, hopefully.
Yeah.
I'll be drinking one of those soon.
Oh, well, yeah. The mojito, which we listened to you mixing up, but you didn't do it here.
I should have. Next time, bring the rum.
And I want to thank my assistant, Kat Johnson, for getting that wonderful tape. Tough job, Kat. You had to go to a bar, right? And she got to drink the product, right?
She said it was good. It was very good.
There is quite a history on that because mint, I mean, we're talking about suddenly in cocktails using herbs that previously were used for medicinal purposes. So mojito was, what's the
background? Oh, yeah.
Background
I mean,
that?
They're like, when we went there, that was, like I said before, something we didn't expect to find to be so delicious, but especially their mint there's something so special about it. It's like, it's very wild and has this other kind of spearminty, and it did feel when we drank the mojito, it was very uplifting, and it was like a healthy tonic, the Cuban mojito.
Mm-hmm. So is there any background tracing on how old that drink is? It just sort of was a natural thing that people did. So who's to know?
Yeah, I mean, a little of both, right? I mean, mint was medicine, alcohol was medicine. They were using it to take care of...
Wow, it makes me feel so good.
Yeah, take care of stomach ailments. A lot of sailors were doing that because, obviously, you know, when you're traveling on a boat, your stomach gets a little messed up, I guess, sometimes.
Yeah, a little queasy.
So they, you know, there's tried to trace it back to where it came from. It could possibly be from Sir Francis Drake's boat, where they were drinking something called the Drake, which was rum and, well, aguardiente and mint. So it goes back a long time.
Yeah, that, yeah. Indeed. It's interesting that something like that is, well, obviously, that makes it a classic. It has staying power.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And what about, well, the famous bar, the Florida? That's where Hemingway hung out, right? That's
yeah,
where
the
you,
La Florida. So, yeah. Yeah. Originally the
La Florida,
Silver Florida. Pineapple.
Yep.
Changed that name because the drink was so good.
Mm-hmm. And so the name of the drink is now the Silver Pineapple or the
Floridita?
Or
it was before, and then they changed it to the La Floridita because there's a series within the Hemingway daiquiri where there are all kinds of modifications where there's one without the grapefruit juice. So as we said, with staying power in these formulas where you can sub in different things, that's definitely up there with the Hemingway daiquiri and
nice.
The series of cocktails.
There are some stories about Errol Flynn. What's going on there with Errol Flynn in Cuba?
Errol Flynn loved Cuba. He went there on his honeymoon and abandoned his new bride on the boat while he ran around tearing it up.
He's definitely a big fan of Cuba and the rum and the rum and coke. There are some good stories about him kind of being the culprit behind those two being mixed together because that was so popular. When we went there, of course, there was no Coca-Cola to be found, so they have a substitute, which was not quite the same.
Yeah.
But it was a cola that they would mix with.
Yeah.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the rum and coke we can be like Errol Flynn and drink a rum and coke.
Yes. Many rum and cokes. Many, many.
Many rum and cokes. Yeah. And of course, what I just found out from, I guess it was from your book, on July 19th is National Daiquiri Day.
I think so, or the 17th? 19th, maybe.
Something. I got it out of your book.
Yes, so. it's daiquiri season, though. Yeah, it's mid-July is the day everyone should have a daiquiri.
I'm going to put it on my calendar for
yes.
sure. Okay. And I'm thinking about highballs or rum or gin rickeys. I mean, something that we've sort of forgotten about a lot in this country. I mean, thanks to bars like yours, they're getting a rebirth, a renaissance. That started in Cuba?
Yeah, quite a popular tipple. I mean, that's definitely, I think it's, is that the national drink in D.C.? It might be. Yeah, that's, you know, we're thinking very little sugar. It's basically your kind of daiquiri spec, but you do it long. And we saw lots of drinks there, and it's amazing. They still kind of do everything, even when they're making a highball, with the bar spoon, pouring the soda down into it and stirring it around before they hand you to drink. And everything's very proper with the tongs and putting the lime on the side.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that all part of the magic, too? I mean, yeah. That's, you know, that technique is it just makes it special. Because after all, you're taking all these same ingredients, but it's the combination of them that just makes...
Yeah, it's very much like baking, the idea of you can
take
so many things.
Yeah.
And it depends on what you do. And that's where kind of things like punch come in, where you'll have the same ingredients, but punch is traditionally not shaken. It would be a stirred, left to sit over a large piece of ice for many hours while everyone imbibed kind of deal, and you get two very different beverages out of the same ingredients.
Well, punch, as we know, has quite a long history if you've listened to a couple of my shows in the past.
Yes,
show number 44. Okay. And we know that punch preceded any cocktail that was ever made, right?
Oh, yeah. It's back there with, you know, again, sailors bringing things around the world with the grog that was, you know, lime and rum and water that basically kind of evolved into a daiquiri and then punch that came around. It's just kind of amazing to see how things travel the world.
Right. And you serve punch at Cienfuegos.
We do. We do big punch bowls and single serving. Punch isn't necessarily just the vessel itself. It's a style of drink that needs to have...
Well, I think a planter's punch right away.
Oh, yes. So there you'd have... You need
the spirit, you need a sweetener, you need a citrus, you need a water, and then or ice or club soda, and then you need some sort of spice. And a lot of times they would use Angostura bitters, which is in the Planter's Punch or other classic. They just love to take a big piece of nutmeg and grate it over the top, and it adds so much. And another kind of stimulating, you know, additive.
But you do use punch bowls when you're doing multiple servings.
Oh, we do, yes.
Oh, what a fun idea. Yeah, to bring back the punch bowl and gather around, all right? We would be remiss if we did not talk about El Presidente. And I think that a lot of people sort of consider that the, you know, the Cuban cocktail.
It's definitely a great showcase for the possibilities of rum. Most things we've spoke about before today are, you know, you're thinking shaken, beach drink. This is more serious. This is, you know, really showcasing a beautiful spirit. It's basically, you know, kind of a rum martini. It's got that staying power, has a little dash of, you know, homemade grenadine to just give it some nice roundness and a little bit of sweetness. And it showcases this, you know, beautiful distilled white rum. It has, you know, an amazing history going back from when I believe a New York bartender went down to Havana to help open a hotel.
Yeah, and the president came to stay. He made a drink for him to commemorate the stay. And then he was deposed a little bit afterwards, and so he changed the drink just slightly and made it a new drink, and, you know.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the early 1920s.
Yeah, it was the second president of the Second Republic of Cuba, kind of.
Yeah. Machado? Yeah.
Yeah, Garcia de... Yeah.
You have to look... Got to look in that book. Look in that history book, right? It's a refined... more of a refined cocktail as opposed to a lot of these.
Yeah, definitely one of our favorites and something that we've seen reoccurring here on more menus. I'm very glad that rum is being taken seriously and not just thought of. I mean, I love tiki cocktails, don't get me wrong, but a good sipping rum or, you know, a solid rum stirred drink is something to really be enjoyed.
Yeah, it's interesting because, we wouldn't have even called it a tiki cocktail if it weren't for the fact that then we couldn't go to Cuba anymore and we had to recreate that experience here in America, right? That's very, very interesting. White rum as opposed to dark rum. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's, you know, sometimes it doesn't really have too much to do with age. It's, you know, rum right now is still a category that's a little fast and loose. There are regulations along the lines of agricole rums, which have to be made from fresh sugarcane juice and, you know, come from French islands. But then you get into some of the other places and islands and, you know, it's a little bit like, well, what's an amber rum? What's, you know, there are all these different things and it still can be very experimental. It's, you know, there are a lot of new American rums, great ones coming from Oni's out here in Brooklyn and St. George and San Francisco. And the rules aren't fully set yet, so it's still a really fun category, and you get to try all these different things. But a lot of dark rums, it's not against the law to add back in caramel or molasses or any form of sugar to kind of add body to things. So definitely when you're going through and tasting things, you have to kind of swirl the glass and sniff through it and kind of see what's going on there with these rums.
Yeah, that's what I wondered about, the difference in taste in particular, and mixability.
Yeah.
If that's what you say.
That's true. I mean, at Cienfuegos and Mother of Pearl, we have many, many rums, and it's something a lot of people do is where you kind of make your own blend. You can take a little bit of a Jamaican rum and a little bit of a Guyanese rum and maybe, you know, a splash of some Puerto Rican rum and make your own blend, and that's what a lot of tiki cocktails are. Hmm. You're getting up there in 5, 6, 7 rums.
Wow.
I have 5 in my zombie recipe, so that we put in the book.
I guess that's why they call it a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Right. Well, there are names that have as much historic connotation as, you know, as the drink, too. And one is the Southern Smith or the Cross, or is it the Southern Cross?
Southern Cross. Yeah.
Southern Cross. What's the significance of that?
That one kind of has a varied history as well. We found some really great recipes online when we were researching, and that one was a lot of fun to kind of go through.
And I mean, it was named after the constellation, yes. The constellation of the cross. So everyone was referring to this constellation they would stare at in the sky. And I guess it made them a little loopy, and so they named a drink after it.
Yeah, we have some references from the Flowing Bowl in 1891, and then you think on to 1927. But definitely it's along the lines of one of those classic specs that you think maybe the margarita might have sprung from. You have the lime and then some kind of citrus liqueur. So that's another classic. You're thinking sidecar with rum. You're thinking between the sheets. You've got these drinks that kind of go in line with all of those.
So it's interesting. Again, there's just a few ingredients, but it's all about the layering. It's all about...
Yeah, the balance of what you're doing, stirring versus shaking, all that kind of stuff. Even glassware is very important. Certain drinks, you want to sit on that piece of ice. Certain drinks like daiquiris, you do not. You want to drink rapidly.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. How much of today's cocktail culture can we attribute to the Cuban influence? Do you think? I mean, did it really have an effect on our cocktail culture today? Do you feel?
I mean, I think so. I think it even just because it kept it alive during Prohibition,
right?
You know, otherwise it would have gone completely across the Atlantic, and how would we get it back so easily? You know, a lot of cocktails, their stems are in that sort of Caribbean style of making drinks. Like tiki's stem got its balance in there. So I think it's got a big influence, whether it's direct or indirect. It kept it going.
Yeah, it was good to keep it so close to home, that flame kind of going, that people went down and they were able to come back so quickly and kind of... You know, we could see it in the style. Everyone, all the bartenders, modern day, they're in their vests and ties, and they're kind of dandies, and they kind of kept that going as well. It was very stylized as well as, you know, classic and very thoughtful about the cocktail itself. But just some of the bars we went to were like the speakeasies here in New York. Kind of, we went to a cool, like, dark dungeon bar that had a big wine cellar, and they wanted to show us all that kind of stuff.
So that got it, huh?
Yeah.
One thing that I see that you've done such a great job with is taken a lot of these classic drinks, too, and sort of made them your own at the bars, as many mixologists will do, you know, create their own. But yet you really pay homage to the classics in them. But a drink that I know could easily become one of my favorite is the May Day that you make with rhubarb. That sounded just wonderful to me.
Yeah, we're coming up on that right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to be putting that back on the menu. And that's one of my series of cocktails. And when we were writing this book, I showed it to Ala, and she thought that it was a great idea to put it in. Aperol and rhubarb bitters. We use a rum agricole, which is really nice and gives it kind of funk and some backbone, a lot of character in those agricole rums.
When you say the agricole rums, so these are more, for lack of a better word, rustic, but farm produced? Or
yeah, you get a lot of, you know, fresh yeast coming off of that sugarcane, unadulterated sugarcane juice. And so there's just so much character. And we're actually going to be going to Martinique tomorrow, or Guadeloupe and Martinique, to learn some more about these amazing rums that...
Wow.
Yeah.
So that'll be a whole new batch of drinks.
Another adventure for us, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, it sounds wonderful, and what an exciting thing to do to travel around to find the sources for all these drinks that we consider, you know, part of our regular cocktail lexicon. And I thank you so much. It makes me want to go to Cienfuegos and, of course, Mother Pearl. And Ala, do you have...
Post office and OTB.
Yeah. Right, of course. Well, thank you both for sharing the history and the recipes and taking time out to share the little bit of a history of the Cuban cocktail culture as well. Thank you. And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. I'd like to thank again my assistant, Kat Johnson, and, of course, as always, my wonderful engineer, Dave Tadashore. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.